Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Dr. Chris Owen. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Michael, for having me.
Well, I'm holding this very impressive tome. You'll know exactly how many pages there are in it.
Too many.
It's an amazing book for many, many reasons. Every mother's son is guilty. That's in quotes.
Yep.
And the subtitle, in a sense, Policing the Kimberley Frontier of Western Australia, 1882 to 1905. This represents, I think, your PhD dissertation.
Yep, substantially, yep.
And there is also, as people will see when they look at this article, taking them to this podcast, a photograph with, 40 or 50 Aboriginal men.
And boys. Boys are at the back.
And they're all chained.
Yep.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Chris, you're a historian. You're an honorary research fellow at the University of Western Australia.
Yep.
You've written this book, and you've also been involved in a project called The Killing Times.
Yep.
Based on data from the Colonial Frontier Massacre Digital Map Project conducted by Professor Lyndall Ryan at University of Newcastle's Centre for the 21st Century Humanities.
Yep.
And that's been given some good publicity through The Guardian Australia.
Yep.
Can you tell me how it was initially that you got to choose your topic for your PhD?
Sure. Michael, in short, I had a very brief career as a high school teacher, and I was trying to teach Australian Aboriginal history to year 8 to 10s. And I was horrified that it hadn't changed much since I went to school, which still has this sort of narrative of Aboriginal people's hunter-gatherers and loincloths with a spear. And the kids simply didn't have any idea about Aboriginal history or culture or anything. So I decided high school teaching wasn't for me. So I went back to uni and started a master's. And I always loved the Kimberley. So I started looking at the Kimberley records, and I started looking at the police records of the Kimberley. And then the most extraordinary bloody things I've ever seen, thousands and thousands of very detailed police records that are required by law and regulation to keep detailed records, and they were in the form of letter books, journals, police journals, things called occurrence books. So every day had to be documented.
Can I just interrupt you there for a minute? It must be a wonderful thing when historians discuss primary sources to know that this level, in a sense, of something people have called out for decades, transparency. Yeah. Way back in those days, the police and I think military forces had to account for every bullet that they were given.
Yeah, exactly.
Every gun that they had.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'd go out on an expedition, or they'd do their day's work, come back and have to fill in all the forms.
Yeah, had to fill out the occurrence book and then post it to Perth, 3,000 kilometres away, to the Commissioner of Police, who's sitting in an office in Perth.
So whether you're in the Subiaco police station or the Derby police station, or the Wyndham police station, you had to do the same thing around the state.
Yeah, biggest police jurisdiction in the world, Western Australia.
And did you have any sense, just to jump ahead in a way, but come back to where you were in a moment, that the police were anything but honest in their accounting for what they did with things?
Well, this is what, to jump ahead, I mean, what really gets me is that there's a lot of really diligent police who tried to uphold the law, the justice. I mean, Aboriginal people were proclaimed British citizens. So you're seeing police trying to uphold the law for Aboriginal people in the same way for white people, except that the social context that they were placed in, where this white colonial society, and particularly up north, the Pilbara and the Kimberley, would just exploit Aboriginal people to their hilt for, pearling, mining, pastoral interests. If police tried to uphold the law for Aboriginal people, they would get what was called blackballed, which was, marginalised from their community, which meant you wouldn't get water or food or help from the white community. So you're seeing this police documenting this in the historical record, and in the end they get so demoralised they basically give up trying to protect Aboriginal rights. But at the same time, I mean, in the Kimberley in the 1890s, when the really serious conflict came up, you'd see police reporting on shooting lots of Aboriginal people, and they'd be pulled up by the Commissioner of Police saying, hey, that's murder, which it was. So you'll see this gradual, how they would frame the attack.
So euphemisms
like
would sneak into it.
We were the subject of an attack by Aboriginal people and had to respond would be, and they were instructed by a police inspector called over in Drury to say this, you're the subject of an attack, you're not attacking people.
Yeah, so there was an accepted, well trodden out form of words.
Yeah, don't write it like that.
But before that happened, you actually found a police commissioner who would refer to what was being reported as murder.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah.
What was, talking about this 1890s period, I mean, Western Australia gets responsible government about that year, doesn't it?
In 1890, yeah.
Yes. So there were some concerns, as I'd always understood it, from the Imperial government back in London.
Yeah.
About how, not just in Western Australia, but probably throughout all of the colonies, Indigenous peoples were treated by the agents of the British Crown.
Yeah.
Did you see that in one way or another evinced as a concern when you were looking at these periods?
God, yeah, it's enormous. I mean, the British government was so concerned about the treatment of Aboriginal people that they inserted a clause in the Constitution that 1% of Western Australian revenue go to to Aboriginal people.
That's a separate topic, isn't it?
It's a whole new topic.
Got repealed at some point.
But you'd probably know of him, Reverend Gribble, who wrote probably one of the most infamous books in West Australian history, Dark Deeds in a Sunny Land. He's talking about, he went up to the Carnarvon, like the earlier colonised Gascoyne Carnarvon period in the 1870s, 1880s, and he wrote a book, and it's the most damning expose of what's going on the regions and the frontiers in the Carnarvon. And he got driven out of the colony and threatened with death.
Too many do-gooders, Chris.
Do-gooders, exactly. That's what he was called.
It is interesting, though, when you point that out, and the Brits back in London insist on this clause going into the first, let's call it, state constitution, 10 years before statehood and federation, because they didn't, in a real sense, trust the morality of the local politicians.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you've mentioned Gribble, which is interesting, but closer to the time that you were looking at and reported on in your PhD and in the book, that period into the early 20th century and just before it, a royal commission gets set up.
Yeah.
And how does that happen?
The 1905 one are you talking about? It's complex, but again, West Australian history, intensely conservative. John Forrest had been Premier, intensely conservative family, landed gentry. His whole Forrest family had this outrageous conflict of interest owning pastoral properties in the Kimberley. Forrest, there'd been calls for a Royal Commission since the 1880s.
Into what?
Into Aboriginal affairs in Western Australia. Forrest rejected it for years and years. So John Forrest, first Premier of Western Australia, rejects it for 10 years.
He goes off to Canberra.
1890, then in 1900 becomes the Federal Minister for Defence. So then you're seeing the birth of the Labor movement, birth of unionism. So you're seeing the Dalglish government, Labor government comes in. It's all these reports just keep popping up.
This is here in WA.
In West Australia, reports of slavery, which was exact term for it in the pastoral industry, in the pearling industry. So you're seeing the Labor government and the influence of unions and that drive this push towards a Royal Commission, and that's what happened in 1904.
And that was Roth.
Walter Roth came over from Queensland.
So they bring a man from Queensland, which is interesting on its
own. Isn't it? Yeah.
They need someone from the other side.
Other sider, yeah.
And you mentioned the unions. I mean, about that same period, the unions were terribly interested in the employment of white Australian workers, and didn't want Orientals coming into the country, and took them a long time to get over a non-white Australia, to receive a non-white Australia policy. What was their interest in having a commission at that point? Were they actually interested in Indigenous people's welfare?
Yeah, in part. I mean, the racism was just pervasive all around Australia.
Yes.
But there was a real interest in you know, basically what on earth is happening in Western Australia, that these reports of, you know, murder and abduction, and particularly of Aboriginal women, just exploitation, comboism, they used to call it, the stealing of Aboriginal women and the trading of Aboriginal women. So there's real interest in this. And then when Roth came over and his report, it's online actually, you can Google the Roth report. It's the most devastating read you could, you know, he called, you know, the condition of Aboriginal people a brutal and outrageous condition of affairs. Mm-hmm. Because they were basically, you know, killed, traded, shot down, incinerated. And Roth was a bit like Gribble, who's driven out of the colony as well. And I think the thing about Roth as well, he only had such a short time frame, because he was classic Royal Commission.
He was good.
You've got to go up there, and you've got 3 months or something to do this enormous job.
Produce the report.
Yeah.
So it was some sort of compromise. We'll have a Royal Commission, but it's going to happen quickly, and we're not going to pay any more than this.
And we're going to interview 42 people. 42. And two Aboriginal people in that, which the report was about Aboriginal people.
We'll come back to this report very directly, because that's the work you did for the book in the end. But it's only 70 years after 1834, in 1904. I've just turned 71. 70 years, I can tell you, is no time. In my grandchildren, teenagers, I can remember exactly that I was a teenager. The reason I'm saying all that is, 70 years before 1904, 1834, something happened at Pinjarra, the place where I was born. And there's been a lot of discussion about Pinjarra. People know a story, sometimes called the Battle of Pinjarra, as though there were two equal forces that lined up across the valley and had a battle. What was the truth of that? Let's just deal with that briefly before we go back to the Kimberleys.
Oh, sure. I think the Battle of Pinjarra, it's really a massacre. It's one of the first and one of the biggest in West Australian history. But it also set the tone for what came to be called the punitive expedition, where government and police, and it was the army then, not the police, would just use overwhelming force to pacify and push the surviving. They killed, you know, 80 to 100 Noongar people in Pinjarra who were resisting the expansion of the white colony. So you use a punitive expedition to pacify, to kill the main threats, which were usually the strong men, pacify the survivors into subservience, the women and the children, and terrify the rest of them. So, and this involved, you know, the leader of the governor of the colony, of the Swan River colony, James Stirling, and also, you know, Robert Peel, one of the premier landowners. So
they all mount their horses,
and
a good number of them, plus police and military, go to the Murray River, right next to where Pinjarra stands today. And the official numbers are less than the 80 and more.
14 or 11, 11 to 14 or so.
Depending on which report you're looking at.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that there's some proper basis to infer that the numbers were greater.
Oh, there's multiple records that say it's up to 80 to 100. And multiple records saying, you know, bodies were floating down the river, and they dug a big hole and dropped 80 corpses in there. And also, you know, Governor Stirling is quoted in the Perth Gazette saying to the survivors, so you can imagine him sitting on his horse with his musket going, if you do this again, you know, that is try and repel white colonisation, I'm going to wipe out every Aboriginal, every native this side of the Scarp, which he means the Darling Scarp. So
yes,
he's talking about extermination of the entire Aboriginal population, and I don't doubt it for a second.
So this, of course, people have to always remember we have this discussion. It's not as if Governor Stirling arrived here and invented these policies. The British had been imperialising over the whole of the planet for a long, long time. This was a way that you brought people under control in all sorts of countries around the
same
world.
India. Yeah, India's the same.
Yes. So there's a story about that, but it's part of a broader story because, as I said at the outset, you've been engaged with others, bringing to the attention of people, as you wanted to with your high school students who were ignorant about these things, what really went on in times gone past. So you concentrate on the Kimberleys, and what's the essence of the story that you discover there? I've mentioned this photograph on the. Yeah. Why are these men all chained, by the way, and boys?
Because it's cheap. Policing was one of the they considered policing the most one of the most expensive public services going. So there was always great reticence to hire more police. So what always struck me, the Kimberleys, the size of England, 27 police for the entire.
We're talking about the east and west Kimberleys, from the top up at Cambridge Gulf down to wherever.
You can just imagine some poor, Irish migrant. Okay, get a horse, get a gun, get on a boat and go up there and sort the natives out.
Here's your uniform.
Yeah. So instead of hiring more and more police, they started to use the chains.
So why were these men in that photograph all chained, and where had they been chained initially, or had they been picked up?
They were picked off their country. I think they're Mirrawong Gadjarong men. So
these men are
those ones. Yeah, men and boys.
So they'll be taken from around east, west, and south of present day Kununurra.
And
from what police station, or to which police station, were they being taken by the police?
Well, the police would go on patrol from, the main centres, Wyndham, Halls Creek, and Derby. They'd go on these massive, they were called bush patrols, that would go for weeks and months. They'd take chains for 40 men. And the thing was just to get them off the pastoral station. And the thing was that when the pastoral industry started, there was 300 cattle or something in the 1882 or whatever.
This is the country, the Mirrawong country in particular, that Dame Mary Durack wrote about in her famous book, readable book, Kings in Grass Castle. So my memory is you don't see many stories about blackfellas in that book.
No, it's a lot of coding about knocking them off, though. So they'd go on, the pastoralists would complain. Oh, sorry, so to go back. So in the 1880s, there's 300 cattle there. By mid-1890s, there's 30,000 cattle to 50,000 cattle. And the problem was that Aboriginal people living on their own country they stopped the production of and weight of cattle by spooking them.
So they're living on their own country.
Yeah.
They've lived there probably for 50 or 60 or more thousands of years.
Yeah.
They remain on their country to this day. And for the record, the Mirrawong people have the earliest of the very earliest native title determinations in Australia on the mainland. So they've remained on their country. People come on and they produce cattle and probably some sheep, and they occasionally take a killer, they spear one.
Yeah.
And they eat it.
Yeah.
And the depredations needed to be punished. Is that basically it?
Yeah. And what I found out was that, these pastoral station owners are just getting hysterical, going, the blacks are killing 7,000 of my cattle. And you look at the maths.
It's a bit hard to believe.
It's impossible. 7, they can't. It's impossible.
They wouldn't have 7,000 spears. They'd be snapping.
But it's just this rhetoric, and it's just to get this attention to get the blacks off the stations, because they want 20 for their station to work on the station for free.
Yes, to work. But the other stockmen,
the other 200, they don't want them there at all. They can go.
You've seen a lot of the early records by pastoral inspectors and police about the bush blacks, as distinct from those
who the station had blacks
happily seemingly working for the owners and the managers. So who are these bush blacks? What are they just living a traditional life?
No, exactly. So they colonized the pastoral industry colonized the Kimberley, but they had no. They still. It's really amazing. They had no idea how many Aboriginal people are up there, and the Kimberley's the second biggest population in Australia besides Queensland.
For Aboriginal people.
For Aboriginal people.
Well, it's a beautiful place, as people who rush up there these days know. Yeah. It's lots of water. It comes at certain times of the year. It's, there's always a pool to drink from.
That's it. And the cattle industry just took off because it's so suited to cattle. Spoiled all the Aboriginal waterholes, destroyed all their food. Colonists shot all the kangaroos and any sort of native food. So you've got this Aboriginal population. Some of them willingly came down, and they used to call it sitting down on the station and starting to work for the pastorals. But a massive proportion just went, you know, this is my country. And you'll see it all through the literature. This is my country. You'll see, you know, what they called the bush blacks, but traditional, you know, Kimberley men and women just saying, you know, piss off, get off my land. And they used to call it, you know, insolent savages. And you'll see this core group of blackfellas who just didn't want the white settlers there at all. And that's where the conflict really starts, and it really ramps up in the 1890s.
Just using the example of Stirling again, being pressed no doubt by Peel, Alexandra Haslark's book of Peel is really fascinating as well. He had a huge investment here to protect, and it wasn't going terribly well, and having Aboriginal people causing a bit of mayhem every now and then probably wasn't improving his chances of selling everything off. But Aboriginal people did strike at settlers, didn't they? There were, if you want to call them murders, there were killings, whatever. We know about Yagan, who was taken out, his father, Midjigaroo, after whom King Square in Fremantle might possibly get named. I mean, things were happening, so there was an... In a sense, it was seen as a good policy response, a reprisal to teach people their place and to stop them being hostile.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And the same things, I'm taking it from what you're saying, and you find this written down in your book, were happening across the Kimberleys.
Yeah. This involves my massacre work with Newcastle. There's a real scale of reprisal. It was basically the lesser ones, killing of stock would provoke a reprisal, the killing of a prize horse or a prized breeding stock would be another level up. But the big one always was if Aboriginal people killed a white person, that was what would provoke and they're called genocidal massacres.
Not an eye for an eye. That's many eyes for an eye.
Many eyes. You'll see, particularly in the East Kimberley, in the Duracs, I mean, I don't know, if Mary wrote about it, when Big Johnny Durack was killed, he was speared in 1886, I think. What would happen, the punitive expedition, it wouldn't be a one-off killing, it would be weeks and weeks of every white person in the district would get on a horse and a gun and go around for weeks and weeks and kill every single person, even over into the NT border. For weeks and weeks, and kill every single person they came across, and terrify the rest into subservience. Mm. So Mary Durack wrote about this, calling it the greatest massacre in the history of Western Australia. Mm. And I think they killed hundreds and hundreds of blackfellas.
So this was all about securing the land grants, whether pastoral leases or, in some cases, freehold in other parts of Australia, which had been given to typically European settlers who'd come here. And that's part of our history. And you would have, presumably from what you've told us, loved to have, at the time you were teaching these teenagers, loved to have laid that out. It would have been a way of getting their attention, would it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've worked with Noongar people. I worked at the Southwest Land and Sea Council for 10 years. And just working with Noongar people, their life story is often just trauma. It's trauma. Or, you know, they were part of the stolen generations, or they were, you know, ancestors were killed. And it's like white people don't have any wider appreciation of that, of what they've endured. And now you see this sort of contemporary, you know, the contemporary problems in Aboriginal communities, and it's even, you know, it's worse now than it ever was. But people don't, you know, don't link that back to the colonisation process or whatever, or the way Aboriginal people have been treated in Western Australian history.
Which, for those people listening to this podcast, and I hope there are lots, is the reason why the Fremantle Shipping News was so anxious to talk to you, Chris, so that people can start to appreciate even more so with some detail this history, particularly a frontier history, although the frontier has a very long period, to explain dislocation, disempowerment, dispossession, and everything socially that comes from that. We're aware of it in white communities, we understand that, but then we look at a whole Indigenous community that's been suffered for so long at the practices in Australia. Now, we had the time when we all said sorry, and Kevin Rudd made a national apology, and for most people that was a very moving experience. And so far you and I have talked about Western Australia, but we've referred to the national project. Is this story, whether it's Pinjarra or parts of specific incidents in the Kimberleys, replicated around the country?
Oh, it's identical.
It's not then that we invented it here.
No, it's, in fact, if you could do a virtual reality thing, you can just see, you know, the settlement in Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania. You see it spreading north into Queensland. Queensland is by far the worst in Australia, and you can see it. So the West Kimberley's colonised by West Australians from Perth. The East Kimberley's more colonised by Queenslanders, and you'll see this sort of where the native police operated in Queensland. They were notoriously just massacre forces. So you'll see this mentality coming over with Queenslanders who just shoot Aboriginal people without batting an eyelid. So you'll see this. You can basically see it spreading across Australia. This there was accepted ways to deal with the natives, and that was, you know, warning, verbal abuse, violence, followed by shooting, murder, then incineration. That was become an accepted way of dealing with it, and it's Australia-wide.
So, in your book, in your dissertation, made into this book, what are the messages? What are the lessons that you're trying to convey to the slightly empathetic reader? What do you want people to take from it?
I always think, you know, and Mary Jurak's a perfect example. These beautiful narratives of, you know, even Kings in Grass Castles. The title itself is, you know, they're very, very happy to claim how they conquered the country and built this empire and built this wealth. And you'll see it down in St. George's Chair. They're very happy to do all that, but they're not very happy to talk about how that happened. And the story of Aboriginal dispossession and murder, and, you know, you can call it genocide in many separate incidences, is just sort of brushed under the carpet, and it's still brushed under the carpet these days.
So part of this is to tell Australia's true history.
Yeah.
And I'm provocatively putting this question to you: why do we need to know Australia's true history?
It's part of, you know, the truth telling narrative. It's time to own up to how the country was colonised, settled, whatever you want to call it. It's really colonised. Always think like 20 years ago, Keith Windschuttle, the author, came out with that fabrication of Aboriginal history, and it saying that none of these massacres, or most of them, didn't occur. It was all, you know, we were all good Christians who colonised the country peacefully and didn't do any of this, and it was all publicised, and all these poor historians got hammered and vilified in the media. That was 20 years ago. Now I think it's that would never fly these days. It's beyond doubt what occurred in the colonisation process. So I think, you know, we have to come to grips with it, and like many other countries dealing with their, like South Africa, for example, dealing with the history, the real history, the honest history of how the country was colonised by white people.
So there's also this question then of Australia seems to keep, in my view, positively, taking leaps in bounds. You know, there was a time not so many years ago when I had the sense that people were a little bit apologetic about having a welcome to country.
Mm.
But now it's something that happens, and it's a genuine process. We seem to, whites meeting blacks, want to engage. And I'm speaking in a very general way. I'm sure there's some who don't, and there are some who do enthusiastically. Mm. But there's a reconciliation process going on, but it's informed by the research you've been doing and others.
Yeah. But I think, you know, so many people just don't have any idea about...
Still don't know. So your book helps to get it out.
Yeah.
The Guardian, through its continuing articles about these things, there's a map showing massacre sites, killing places all around the country, which you'll find with this podcast. Has the work all been done, or is there still a lot to be done?
Oh, it's still so much to be done. I did the West Australian side of that massacre map, and the definition of a massacre was 6 people or more.
Yep.
If you wanted to pull that back, because it's an international definition of a massacre, if you wanted to pull that back to, say, for example, 2 people or more, it would be 10 times the amount of dots on the map. And I might say stage 4 of that's coming out in July. So there's another, it's probably another 25 being added to sites being added to Western Australia, and probably another 100 or so in the rest of Australia.
Yes. Now, one of the issues coming out of all of this, I suppose, is it finding its way into curricula? Or is this just being talked about in a public way?
No, it is. The massacre map, the Newcastle massacre map, has gone international now. So it's a beautifully simple concept, visually, you know, attractive to people, fully sourced. So if anyone wanted to criticise it or go through it methodically, you could... I always say, be my guest, go for it, go and look at the footnotes, go and look at the references, it's all there.
Historians typically like to, you can't always do this in some settings, go to primary sources.
Mm.
In WA you can go down to the Batty Library and ask to see this and that and find police records, and you can interrogate them, to use the sort of academic expression. And usually, I think they're very clear, aren't they? I mean, they're... Apart from the euphemisms, as you were talking about, that grew into it, they speak for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. That's why we're very fortunate in WA to have such an extraordinary state record archive. Even the colonial, besides the police records, which are very thorough, colonial secretaries' records, the correspondence between Western Australia and Britain, this enormous alarm from senior, you know, the Attorney General, say... there's a bloke, Wharton, who was extraordinary, just going, you know, just what on earth is going on in the Kimberley? There seems to be an awful lot of killing going on up there.
And what was his position?
He was the, I think he was the Attorney General for Western Australia.
So and this was really the other question I wanted to raise with you. I have a sense when you immerse yourself in documentation and you're reading so widely about things, you get a feel for what the community was thinking and saying at the time.
Yeah.
And very often when you're living in the, well, no longer in the 20th century, here we are, already 1/5 of the 21st century has passed us by, and you think that we're in a different state of consciousness, perhaps in a wonderful state of advanced cultural appreciation of things. But the more I read, the more I think that in the period 1900 to 1910, it might have been a lot different from today. There was a lot of indignation around. Yeah. Did you develop a sense of what the colonial or that state, the newly federated Australian populace were thinking, what people in Western Australia were thinking about all of this?
That's it. I think you nailed it. It's fascinating because the Kimberley is literally the last frontier of Australia. So you're looking at all the killing that went on in Sydney and Melbourne, Tasmania. You know, it's 100 years before. Suddenly, we're a federated nation. All this new media, the newspapers are out. Suddenly, there's all this killing going on in the Kimberley. And people are going, what the... This, you know, it's 1910, even up to, you know, the Forest River Massacre. 19, this is not acceptable in a, you know, a Commonwealth of Australia. So you're seeing this is where the conspiracy of silence, the whole idea that you just keep all this under your hat and the whole colonist community would kill, or, you know, 10 of the colonist community would kill, you know, 100 black fellas, and another 1,000 knew about it but kept their mouth shut. And this is where you'll see the real conspiracy of silence thing going on. But it comes back to, you know, are the white colonists going to have the country, or are the blacks going to have it? And that's where the killing and the subjugation came in. So you're just seeing this extraordinary explosions of violence just to pacify these troublesome blacks, as he used to call it.
Everybody knows, going back to the Kimberleys, and we're getting close to the end of our discussion, which I myself have found very enlightening, thank you, Chris. Plays and books have been written about Jandamarra. And he was well known, but was he alone as a person who reacted to white colonisation?
He was certainly one of the major forces, but there was multitudes of other less well known black fellows who just resisted colonisation and used to fight back with grabbing white weapons and, you know, real Ned Kelly sort of stuff. But they're not well known about, and they were just, you know, termed in those days as the treacherous blacks, you know,
who the couldn't treacherous
be
blacks.
Treacherous blacks who wouldn't be part of the, you know, the white community, because they weren't paid anything. They're, you know, and the thing we haven't discussed is Aboriginal women were just you know, it's shocking, but they were called black velvet and traded. And that's one of the main reasons for many of the reprisals of white settlers who would take Aboriginal women from family groups or bands or whatever. And the men
would react.
Men would, not surprisingly, you know, and spear the perpetrator. Mm. So you're seeing this reprisal and that, and that's, of course, would generate the punitive expedition.
Mm. This was all done, as you used the expression earlier, to pacify the indigenous community. Presumably, at the more generous level, the hope was that the Aboriginal people would no longer make the insistent demands for country. They would no longer resist the white occupation and settlement of their traditional country. Did that policy objective succeed? Was there a true pacification of Indigenous people?
Yes, without doubt. Those that worked on the pastoral stations, and the whites would openly admit, we can't make any money without the free Aboriginal labour. So you got these ones that sit down on the stations, the rest are either killed or terrorised into submission, or just pushed to the margins of, and you'll see it in every town in Western Australia and Australia, pushed to the margins of the white settlement, left to, you know, often becoming beggars or starving. And you'll only see the rebirth of rights when the pastoral industry and the Aboriginal push for equal wages, and you'll see that in the 1940s and 50s. Yes. But otherwise, I mean, some of the records, say for Kalgoorlie or Leonora Laverton, are just shocking. You know, police used to, the Commissioner of Police, he was a sergeant, he used to ride down the street on his horse with a stock whip, 6 o'clock every night in Laverton, and also in Kalgoorlie, with a stock whip, just going whoosh, driving them out of town. You know, can you imagine that? 6 o'clock, time to get the blacks out. You know, it's just shocking.
Well, Chris, you've made this part of your life work, and thank you for writing your book. Where does your research take you at the moment? Are there new levels and directions and so on in this research for as they'd say in the Kimberleys and the East Kimberleys, a Gardia fellow like you, a white fellow to pursue?
Well, to be honest, that book nearly did me in, so...
Well, it's a very thick book. If you drop it on your foot.
It's a lot of work. I'm toying with the idea of doing a history of policing in Western Australia. But, I'll just... When my kids get a bit older, I might have a dig at it. But it's very draining.
In the meantime, keep thinking about that.
Yeah.
And thank you for what you have done so far. And thank you very much for coming and talking about what can be a difficult topic, but a very important one to communicate more broadly.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.